Hello, everybody. We're gonna do something tonight we've never done before. We're gonna start on time. How many of you are in for a doubleheader tonight? Hollywood Nye? Hollywood Nye? That could be a movie. There. We're committed to getting you out of here a little before 7, if not sooner than that. The lecture proper should end by quarter out, and we'll take Q&A for a while. You can feel free then to leave and get on over to the Knapp Center here, Bill Nye. So I'm going to keep the introductions short this morning. I think probably all of you know me. My name is Tim Knepper. I teach philosophy and religion here at Drake University, and I direct the program that is sponsoring the event tonight, the Comparison Project. The Comparison Project does global philosophy of religion in the local Des Moines community. By that we mean we do global philosophy of religion and think about how to do comparative religion and philosophy of religion globally in a way that includes all the religions. That component of the program is largely represented by the lecture and dialogue series, which you're at tonight. As I think all of you know, what's our theme for this year and next? Death and dying. We have one more year after this of death and dying. Plenty of death and dying to go around. We also work in the local community through a Religions of Des Moines initiative to create interactive guides, introductions to local religious communities, information about them, digital stories that show off their practices. And we're working toward, as many of you know, the publication of a photo-illustrated set of narratives about 15 different religious communities in Des Moines. We have students doing research right now. That book will be out in about a year. And the proceeds of the sale will go to support the Des Moines Area Religious Council. Thank you, Sarah Rice, Director of DMORC, for being here tonight. I want to thank all of our sources, including DMORC, the Drake University Center for the Humanities, the Drake University Principal Financial Group Center for Global Citizenship, the Medbury Fund, Humanities Iowa, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, same twice. Thank you twice. Cultivating Compassion, the Richard Deming Foundation, and Isles Funeral Homes, which is our special series sponsored for the program on death and dying. Also, thanks to all those who helped behind the scenes, Leah Cowanson, Mary Gottschalk, Kayla Jenkins, and Isaiah Enochson. As you all know, we have sign-up sheets that go around. One of our sponsors asked us to take attendance. If you want to be on our emailing list or Humanities Iowa's emailing list, you can supply your email address and check the appropriate box. Otherwise, all you need to do is sign your name so we have a count of how many people were here tonight. More information outside, brochures, flyers on the book project. There are feedback sheets if you want to give feedback on tonight's event for the sake of Humanities Iowa, so on and so forth. Well, we're thrilled tonight to have a little Hollywood with us. Amy Hollywood, and we have at Drake and Amy Letter, who teaches English. And when I first came to Des Moines, I sometimes went to the Church of an Amy Miracle. But you don't teach about Hollywood.
Well, I have.
Amy Hollywood, we're thrilled to have her with us from Boston. Amy Hollywood is the Elizabeth H. Monrad Professor of Christian Studies and the chair of the Committee on the Study of Religion at Harvard University. Her BA is from Bryn Mawr College, and her MA and PhD are from the University of Chicago. She is the author of The Soul as Virgin Wife, Mechtild of Magdeburg, Marguerite Perret, and Meister Eckhart. This book received the Otto Grundler Prize for the Best Book in Medieval Studies from the International Congress of Medieval Studies. She's also authored Sensible Ecstasy, Mysticism, Sexual Difference, and the Demands of History. And she is the co-editor of the Cambridge Companion to Christian Mysticism. I don't know quite what to expect tonight, but I know I'm going to enjoy it. A performative and meditative talk about how we imagine our own deaths and the deaths of others. Please join me in welcoming Amy Hollywood.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out, and I'll try to stay in the time limits. Tim kept asking me for a description of what I was going to do, and I was having a very hard time coming up with one. There's two things that I've been thinking about a lot lately that are going to come out in what I say in the next 35 to 40 minutes. The first is a shared interest, simultaneous interest in the difficulty of contemporary poetry and prose and the difficulty of dying. And the reason these two questions have been so linked in my mind is that in the context of mourning the deaths of many, who I will talk about some in what follows, I found myself very often attracted to reading things that I couldn't understand. And that the act of reading something I couldn't understand was doing an enormous amount of emotional work for me that I didn't understand. And so I'm trying to figure out what that lack of understanding is about and what it is about reading certain kinds of poetry and philosophy and prose that is extremely ineffable, has a quality of ineffability to it, to go to an earlier theme, that I was drawn to in experiences of mourning. The other thing I would say is that what I'm going to do in what follows, there's a somewhat eclectic format, and there's going to be multiple voices that occur. Sometimes I think you might not know who the I is who's speaking, and I would say don't worry about that, and I can help sort it out in the question and answer, but the multiplicity of the I's who are speaking is in some sense part of what I'm trying to do. Okay, so two citations at the outset. One from the poet Susan Howe and her book That This, which was written in the wake of her second husband, actually it was her third husband, but anyway, her second husband's death. He was the second husband who died. She was married three times, and it doesn't matter. Okay, starting from nothing with nothing when everything else has been said. And the second is a quote from John Taggart, a very good friend of Susan Howe's, a poet, and wrote an essay a few years ago called The Spiritual Definition of Poetry, in which he writes this: "The history of poetry in our century is only superficially the history of the struggle to make it new. More enduring is the struggle to regain the definition of poetry as spiritual aesthesis." So one of the things I'm interested in asking is what it means to make and read poetry as spiritual aesthesis. What does it mean to read and write devoutly, religiously, mystically? And are these even the right words? Reading the writing that I love, some of it commonly known as novels, some of it known as poetry, raises these questions for me in particularly acute ways. I would venture to guess that for Henry James and Robert Frost, who will play a role in what follows, as well as many other writers that I love to read, writing is itself a kind of reading, and both writing and reading are inexhaustible attempts to hear God, or absent God, to hear that other, those others that we glimpse, hear whispers of, just barely touch in the acts of reading and writing themselves. Reading and writing are forms of divination. James and Frost and David Foster Wallace, all of whom will play a role in what follows, may not hear God, but their writing is itself perhaps an inscription of the divine, however fragmentary and partial, for they are deeply committed to the movement of thought, to the articulation of affect or emotion, and to an engagement with that aspect of existence irreducible to the individual or to reified conceptions of the group or the community. The late Reginald Shepherd, a poet, explains in his anthology Lyric Postmodernism that none of the techniques of the contemporary poetry he anthologizes are new, or I would add, are they deployed solely in poetry. This is his list: syntactical fracture or deformation, quotation, pastiche, collage, montage, cinematic jump cuts, polyvocality or multiplication of voices, irony, parody, the mingling of kinds of diction and discourse from very high to very low, intentional catachresis, which is the incorporating of the inappropriate, some of which will happen in what follows, inviting error, associative rather than linear logic, seriality and juxtaposition instead of narrative or extended meditation. All of these features that Shepherd lists for us can be found in the work of the high modernists, the early 20th century. the difficulty of much contemporary writing around the beginning of the 21st and end of the 20th century mirrors that of modernism and of modernism's precursors. What is new, according to Shepherd, is that unlike high modernism, the contemporary poetry he gathers refuses the possibility of synthesis, of recreating a whole out of the fragments. To that I ask, is it right to say that high modernism is always about creating a whole out of the fragments? Or does it tell us more about the reception, and particularly the academic reception of high modernism? And is it true that in the contemporary world, real poets, and that is a little bit of Shepherd's impact, demand unmitigated fragmentation? Or are some of them not also seeking wholeness? For me, the vital point, for me, the vital point is that the difficulty I love is a difficulty that does not call for expert deciphering. Yeah, I can hear the difference. Sorry about that. There is no good.
Yes.
There is no hidden code known only to elite readers, although there are often shibboleths, secrets in plain sight, but legible only to those without power. Instead, the forms of difficulty I love solicit the reader. This is the part you didn't miss anything good. the forms of difficulty I love solicit the reader to linger in the place of the just barely and sometimes not quite explicable. That is often the space of death. Hence the ascesis, but also the ecstasy engendered through the reading and, I imagine, the writing of this work. When I think about religion and what we grandiosely call literature, I'm less interested in the exploration of religious themes or images, although they are strewn throughout the work of those that I'll discuss here, than in the analogies and disanalogies between literary practice and religious practices of writing and reading. The practices of religious elites, and increasingly not only elites, in Western Christianity circled endlessly around the Psalms in the Bible, with reading, recitation, song, and meditation leading to the production of new songs in and through engagement with the biblical text. Those raised within Christian and Jewish traditions often forget how difficult the Psalms are, not just formally, but also in their vivid and incredibly complex imagery, in the harshness of the world and the God they depict, in the truths they purport to tell. For early Christian theologians, theorists of the Psalms and literary critics all, and often also poets, the Psalms are at the heart of the Christian life because, and this is the key claim, they contain the entire range of human emotion. Through uttering the words of the Psalms, so these theologians argued, and looking from the book of Scripture to what Bernard of Clairvaux in the 12th century calls the book of experience, moving back and forth between the two, so that the words of the psalmist and the words become one's own and emerge spontaneously from one's lips, Christians come to understand who they are, who God is, how they stand individually and communally before, with, and in that God. Now, the Psalms are not my scripture, but since I was a small child, I've read religiously. Perhaps I've even begun to write that way. And that is what I see vividly, complexly, difficultly in the work that I love. I'm going to skip an example I have here of an odd poem by Fanny Howe. I'm going to do it. An atypical juxtaposition from Fanny Howe's Tis of Thee, this was written in 2003, chosen almost at random. X is an African-American man, Y a European-American woman, Z their grown mixed-race son. X and Z. Any discussion of race is really a discussion about the creation of the universe. And there's a page break. Y, the mother, says, "Now I believe that when the Messiah comes, the world will have no images, since the image will be cut free from the object, released like beef from a cow, and competition will automatically founder as an instinct, having no visible object in sight. Then on that day, I won't have to look for you in order to know you." I don't believe in the Messiah, but I believe in Fanny Howe. What does that make me? All right, let me start again. The history of Christianity might be written as a history of technologies, bodily and spiritual practices through which subjects and communities are constituted. What we see in the early and medieval periods is an intense theorization of, or theological reflection on, these techniques and on how they work together with and as God's grace to form the life of Christian perfection. The monastic life is initially the privileged site for these technologies. In it, monks and nuns, either individually or in community, enact the continual praise of God that is heaven itself.
At the heart of this practice, as I've said, lies the recitation, chanting, or singing of the psalms. For John Cassian, a 5th century figure, key to the development and theorization of Christian monasticism in the Latin West, the techniques of repetition central to the monastic life are not at odds with, but produce spontaneity. Dying and dead monks still today, and nuns still today, are surrounded by their communities who recite or sing the psalms over them. In the High and Late Middle Ages, these practices moved out of the confines of the monastery. There were beguines, semi-religious women, who took informal vows but lived in the world, dedicated to God and to Christian perfection, and they were often employed to care for the sick and the dying. This included reciting or singing the psalms over the dying, perhaps at times with them. Did they sing in Latin, the key language of the psalms in the Christian Middle Ages in the West? Or did they sing in French, Flemish, German, Italian, English, or other vernaculars? I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems clear that many of the dying may not have understood the words of the songs that were being sung over them. This is the background against which I want to talk about how we die now. And the we here is those of us, myself, many not in this, probably not shared with many in this room, who are no longer Christian, or Hindu, or Jewish, or Buddhist. I will speak in terms of what the literary critic Michael Warner calls ethical secularism, a version of secularism that refuses the structure and contrast of neutral procedure against personal commitment, but instead understands secularism itself as a form of commitment. For Warner, and I don't know if I agree with him, but I'm going to use this for now. For Warner, ethical secularism asks how we live now, those of us for whom religious practices are no longer formative. In Warner's words, quote, ethical secularism presents itself as a project for becoming the kind of person who can rightly recognize the conditions of existence. And although it is an attempt to overcome Christianity, it does not secure its stance as a privileged default against the particularities of religion. I'd like to say that I don't wish to overcome Christianity. And I'd like to say that death demands particularity. But for me, as for many others, Christianity is simply, and there's nothing simple about it, gone. So I have a fantasy that when I'm dying, someone will read to me the opening pages of Henry James' The Portrait of a Lady from 1881. Here's the opening paragraph. Under certain circumstances, there are few hours in life more agreeable than the hour dedicated to the ceremony known as afternoon tea. There are circumstances in which, whether you partake of the tea or not, some people, of course, never do, the situation is itself delightful. Those that I had in mind beginning to unfold this simple history offered an admirable setting to an innocent pastime. The implements of the little feast had been disposed upon the lawn of an old English country house in what I shall call the perfect middle of a splendid summer afternoon. Part of the afternoon had waned, but much of it was left, and what was left was of the finest and rarest quality. Real dusk would not arrive for some hours, but the flood of summer light had begun to ebb, the air had grown mellow, the shadows were long upon the smooth, dense turf. They lengthened slowly, however, and the scene expressed that sense of leisure still to come, which is perhaps the chief source of one's enjoyment of such a scene at such an hour. From 5 o'clock to 8 is on certain occasions a little eternity, but on such an occasion as this, the interval could only be an eternity of pleasure. There are three men on the lawn in this not so very innocent scene, an old man and two younger, a father, a son, and a son's friend. There are also two dogs, a collie and a bristling, bustling terrier, who only later, in passing, we will find to be named Bunshee, the name of my imaginary dog. All of the names come later. Daniel Touchett and Ralph, his son, are both dying. Their history, and that of the young woman who comes to join them, may seem simple, even banal. I once had a friend ask me why anyone cared about Isabel Archer, the young woman. How can one speak of eternity with respect to an afternoon tea? A little eternity, and hence no eternity at all. And yet, beyond the irony and the boredom, on this occasion, an eternity of pleasure. I found myself thinking about this scene in James and my own imaginary deathbed scene, during which I am remembering James or listening to some unspecified person reading James to me, while reading, entirely by accident, a book by a critic of poetry, David Orr, Beautiful and Pointless, The Guide to Modern Poetry. Orr wants to argue against the notion that poetry needs to be something grand, dealing with the sublime and the eternal, in order to be interesting and worth spending one's time on. Poetry, he writes, quote, seems beautifully pointless or pointlessly beautiful, depending on your level of optimism, end quote. An afternoon tea on a beautiful lawn, dipping down to the Thames. James refuses to leave its beauty alone. Orr's line marks the end of a section. A new one begins, the penultimate of the book. This is Orr. My father died of cancer in March of 2007 as I was beginning work on this book. He was 61. It's difficult to type those sentences for many reasons, not least among them the fact that I've been a book critic for over a decade now, and almost always find myself cringing, doing the inevitable fetch me a tissue moment in any personal essay or memoir. Still, throughout this book, and especially in this chapter, I've tried to suggest what a relationship with poetry actually looks like in both its limitations and its strength. I've described it as a private pleasure and an occasional irritation that can't easily be justified in public terms. Having said this, I'd be falling short if I didn't try to offer some sense of what, for me, poetry has proven it can and can't give. Sad as it may be, we often discover the true contours of any relationship in the situations that matter most to us. And sadder still, those situations tend to be one in which someone or something we love is lost or in danger of being lost. So pull out your tissues and let's talk about it. I've got a lot of these stories. My father died at 65 when I was 23. My oldest brother and mother died 9 years later, in Pedro's case, almost to the day after my father's death. My mother 4 days after my brother. My brother Michael died in 2013 on the same date as Pedro. Between them, a sister and another brother, my best brother, Daniel. And that's not all. I could give a shit about tissues. Cancer, Orr writes, can kill you in many ways. His father, in the midst of and likely caused by chemotherapy, had a stroke that left him partially paralyzed and unable to shift the pace, intonation, or stress of his words. Suffering from what is sometimes called flat affect, surely a misnomer. The voice is flat, but the affect? Perhaps it's just easier to think that what we can't hear isn't there. Orr's father couldn't, quote, slow down and modulate his voice. A speech therapist gave him various exercises meant to help. Cancer can suffocate you, rot you from the inside out or from the outside in, make you hurt so badly you can't scream. It can give you a heart attack or tangle your guts so that you heave up your own waste. No one wants to know all the ways that cancer can kill you. As Orr self-deprecatingly explains, the not unself-interested thought occurred to him that poetry might also help his father. It deals often with, or perhaps better in, the stress of meter, the intonations engendered by rhythm and rhyme, the pacing needed to articulate assonances and alliterations. Flush with inspiration, Orr writes, quote, I searched the house for my leftover college books and returned to Dad armed with the fruits of English poesy. Here is something I learned very quickly. Do not attempt to get a stroke victim to read Hopkins. I caught this morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dapple, dawn, drawn, falcon. I can barely pronounce that myself and I have full use of my tongue. We did a little better, he writes, with Robert Frost. I gave my father the collected poems of Gerard Manley Hopkins for Christmas a year or two before he died. I don't know why. Orr and his father read from The Silent Tent, or The Silken Tent, excuse me, Orr citing the opening 4 lines of Frost's poem. She is as in a field a silken tent at midday when the sunny summer breeze has dried the dew and all its ropes relent, so that in guise it gently sways at ease. Orr reflects on what he loves in the poem, its technical virtuosity, the entire poem is one sentence, and what he calls the delicate exactness of the first line. She is as in a field a silken tent, rather than, for instance, she is like a silken tent in a field. That would, in fact, have been a very bad poem. For Orr, following the critic Robert Park, quote, the metaphor of the tent does not merely describe the she of the poem, but rather the relationship between the speaker and the woman observed, end quote. Not sure I agree with that, but let's go forward. What Orr likes about it is that Frost, in giving a relation, the metaphor itself, she is like a tent, about a relation, his relationship with the her who is like a tent, does something, quote, more unusual and more difficult, end quote, than poets normally attempt. Orr admits, though, that none of this meant anything to his father. Or perhaps better, he assumes, on the basis of what his father says to him about the poem, that its technical virtuosity meant nothing to him. For his father, the tent was interesting. It reminded him of tents pitched in open fields by traveling circuses, a sight he recalls from his own childhood. True and interesting as this was, Orr writes, and glad as it made me to see him enjoying himself a little, there was something in this response that left me feeling slightly deflated on behalf of my art form. For if reminiscence was all that was needed, we could just as easily have been reading a magazine article about P.T. Barnum. Wasn't there something in the sound of the poem that should have come through? The syntax, the expert maneuvering that Frost does in order to unload the poem's only four-syllable word in the poem's ultimate line, in the capriciousness of summer air. Couldn't Dad hear that? Shouldn't it help somehow? To which I say, help with what? Orr doesn't tell us if the meter and the rhythm of the poem made his father better able to bring intonation into his speech. That was, I thought, the point of the exercise. Given that Orr doesn't tell us whether reciting the poem helped his father, I'm going to assume that what served as the justification for the exercise was not its real agenda. And why can't a magazine article about P.T. Barnum be a poem? Instead of telling us about his father's voice, Orr tells us about his father's reminiscences. And the circus, clearly, is not sufficiently profound for Orr, not least because it doesn't seem to require poetic form for its elicitation. But is the clever use of syntax and metaphor in itself valuable? Should his father be taking the pleasure in the poem that Orr takes? And without that specific technical pleasure, is the poem a waste of time? Does poetry require formal difficulty in its execution and in our appreciation of that execution in order to be worthwhile? Does anything? I mean, these are questions I'm asking about poetry, but we could expand them. And do we have to be able, this is the key question for me, do we have to be able to recognize, analyze, and describe these technical achievements in order to take pleasure in them? Might his father have been taking pleasure in that which he could not himself have explained? And then there's a question, and then there's the question of meaning. Frost's poem isn't that hard to understand, and I'll read it for you in a minute in its entirety. Arguably, its technical virtuosity is hidden by the relative simplicity of its meaning. Some readers of poetry, those who love secrets, might scoff at its lucidity. But there are secrets, and there are secrets. So, does Orr suppose his readers know the poem, that they will go look it up? I'm assuming he couldn't get copyright for the whole poem, and that's why it's not in the book. Or is he hoping that they won't? Anyway, I did. In my copy of The Complete Poems of Robert Frost, 1930, reprinted, second printing, 1949, on the flyleaf, For Jimmy, /21 December 50/Joe, from my dad to my mom on her 29th birthday. There's a Sunday Peanuts featuring good old Charlie Brown, folded into force and tucked neatly into the front cover of the book. Sally, your beach ball is floating away. It's going clear across the lake. Stay calm, big brother, stay calm. She addresses the ball. She yells, okay, you stupid beach ball, come back here right now or I'll see to it that you regret it for the rest of your life. The ball returns. You have to know how to talk to a beach ball, says Sally. Who thought this was so funny that they needed to save it? What did it mean to them? There's a golf joke in there somewhere. And my brother, Daniel. Okay, the poem. She is in a field, a silken tent, at midday, when a sunny summer breeze has dried the dew and all its ropes relent, so that in guise it gently sways at ease, and its supporting central cedar pole, that is its pinnacle to heavenward and signifies the sureness of the soul, seems to owe naught to any single cord, but strictly held by none, is loosely bound by countless silken ties of love and thought to everything on earth the compass round. And only by one's going slightly taut in the capriciousness of summer air is of the slightest bondage made aware. Unquote. This central cedar pole that is the pinnacle of the tent to heavenward signifies the sureness of the soul, of her soul. When no particular string pulls, the pole and its tent seem free, seems to be floating, although Frost does not use the word, despite, in fact, because it is loosely bound by countless silken ties of love and thought to everything on earth to compass round. The more plentiful our ties, the more sure, the more upright and capacious the soul. But when one pulls, the speaker of the poem perhaps, the mere chance of summer breeze, only then is it, but of course the tent isn't aware, only she is, only then is she made aware of her bondage, however slight. After my brother Daniel died, my sister had a dream. She was late for church, standing in the back looking to see if she could find a seat. Daniel was there in full pew with his daughters and me and my brothers and my other sister and my sister's kids, far too many for one pew. When we were kids, we could squeeze six into one pew, but that still meant two for the whole family, and endless fights over who had to sit with my mother. But Daniel gestured to my sister to come and to sit in the pew. She did, and we were all there, and there was more than enough room for everybody. That was my brother's heart. There's more in the Frost poem than might immediately catch one's eye. As my father lay dying, I read Tertullian's On the Resurrection of the Flesh. It was for school. My father's edemic leg hung outside the bedclothes. My always so composed, so elegant, so immaculate father's body cast into disarray by pain and disease. My father, who dead drunk, passed out with a cigarette so carefully balanced between the fingers of his right hand as it lay, folded gently on his left, across his chest, that only a perfect column of ash was left hours later when I found him, afraid to put the stub in the tray lest it scatter ash over his unburnt hand or shirt or the white sheet on which he lay. My father, who his leg run over twice by a drunken friend, got up, walked to the driver's side, and took the wheel. My father, who caught me when I fell, blood running down his bright white shirt. His swollen leg and foot fell out of the bedclothes. I wanted to grab hold and pull him back into this oh so painful flesh. Poetry, Gore concludes, needs a history with its reader. I don't think I'd ever, I've read this poem a million times now, but at the time I don't think I'd ever read this poem. And I am unlikely to have made the technical observations so important to Gore. But I've read a lot of poems. There's history and there's history. But for Orr, poetry, to be useful or helpful or whatever it is he's seeking, quote, needs to have been read and thought about and excessively praised and excessively scorned and quoted in melodramatic fashion and misremembered at dinner parties. It needs, in a particular and occasionally ridiculous way, to have been loved. If poetry could do nothing for my father that a thousand other things couldn't do, that was because it hadn't been a part of his life. Just as when Aunt eventually laid low, I will take little comfort in cello concertos and origami. So, do Christians need to have spent their lives reciting psalms, being shaped by the poem's sound and their content, by the work monks and nuns do with and to the psalms, in order for their recitation or singing as they die to be helpful? Why then sing psalms over the beds of the dying, even those of the laity who may not have been particularly devout, although the psalms were everywhere, and so everywhere heard in the Middle Ages? A friend of mine, a very late Christian, lay with his eyes closed as the church choir sang around his bed. But what he seemed most to enjoy, or so I like to imagine, were the tidbits from a biography of Louis Sikofsky I was reading as we sat together in the late spring sun. He lay with tubes attempting to stem the flow of waste that otherwise would come periodically from his mouth. Yet Orr knows that the story about technical expertise as a source of pleasure and distraction in the face of death is inadequate, because his father did respond with intense pleasure to at least one poem. But as Orr writes, quote, when he did so, it wasn't because of some rarity unearthed by the expertise of his clever son, or because of the uncanny genius of one of the definitive poems of our language. What Orr's father loved and enjoyed for a few of his dying days was Edward Lear's The Owl and the Pussycat. My friend loved this poem too. The Owl and the Pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money, wrapped up in a 5-pound note. This is Orr. To say that this delighted my father would be putting it mildly. I don't know whether his familiarity with the poem arose from some dim memory from his own childhood, or whether he read a similar book to me or my sister when we were kids, but I heard about the pea green boat for at least 3 weeks. We would sit there, my mother, dad, and I, and sometimes my sister, and work our way over and over through the land where the bong tree grows, near the wood where the piggy wig stood. It was happy silliness soon to end, and surely there were 100 other things that might have given my father the same comfort. But this absurd poem was, in its own small way, something. Here is the end of the owl and pussycat, and War cites it. Dear pig, are you willing to see for 1 shilling a ring? Your ring, said the piggy, I will. So they took it away and were married next day by the turkey who lives on the hill. They dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon. And hand in hand on the edge of the sand, they danced by the light of the moon. Moon, the moon. They danced by the light of the moon. I really like, said the poor stout, the runcible spoon. Reader, there are worse things to like or to love. It's the end of War's book. In Infinite Jest, a novel I've never read, David Foster Wallace has his character, Remy Marat, a Quebecois terrorist, say, choose with care, you are what you love, no? Truth or truism, this is just the sort of literary pronouncement David Orr finds deeply embarrassing. So do I, a lot of times. When writers proclaim that poetry and fiction can radicalize consciousness, transform the political sphere, recreate the everyday world, provide the sole and necessary grounds for ethics, usher us safely and quietly into death, I cringe. Poetry and fiction are marks on the page and sounds. Who knows why Orr's father liked Lear better than Frost? Although I have a feeling it has less to do with prior knowledge of the poem than with the ability of the poem to help him articulate sound, and with it, perhaps, feeling, feelings of whimsy and humor. My sister in a fever as she died. Somebody said, better get used to it. We laughed and laughed. My sister, I feel, was unconscious. Sounds elicit whole worlds of feeling. They are amongst the strongest and arguably the last of the strings that hold us to earth and enable us to reach heavenward. My sister and I sang to Daniel snatches of half-remembered songs as he gasped out his last morphine-slowed breaths. A novel by Henry James or David Foster Wallace, a poem by Robert Frost or Edward Lear, a Beethoven violin concerto or a Dum Dum Girl song, it's the same, the listening, the reading, the repetition, the way something we love pulls us back to earth, even as it lets us fly. That's what I love. In my dreams, my daydreams, my night dreams, it's what I am. One last thing. Someone close to me said that he doesn't care what goes on at his funeral, except that he wants loud music. Really, really loud music. So what's the aging hipster's version of the Psalms? It's a Dum Dum Girl song. No, it's a game. Hold tight. Candles, shut your eyes, shut out the light. Death is so bright. From dreams you wake to shock, to find it's true. But she's not you. No, she's not you. And you'd do anything to bring her back. Yes, you'd do anything to bring her back. Oh, I wish it wasn't true, but there's nothing I can do except hold your hand. Except hold your hand till the very end. The words are good. But it's the wall of sound, the layers of feedback, the echoing, resonating chaos of it all that brings the house down. Thank you.
It's tremendous and very performative. Thank you.
I should start singing at the end.
Yeah, you could have. We have some time for questions. This is the sort of talk, it will take us some time to come up with questions, I think, we need. I might ask the first question while they're working on their own questions.
Sure,
just
of
if you can, I love the title, Secular Death. If you can talk some about the title in light of the performance.
Great, yeah, absolutely. That's one
title that it has, and that's the title I gave to you guys because I figured for a broad audience thinking about comparative religion, it was important to mark the fact that I was going to talk about how or make references and think about how we think about death within a non-explicitly religious frame. So really, I mean something pretty low level by secular. I just mean, you know, that question of even, I was in Sweden a couple years ago, and the Swedish church is dying, but the churches are all still open, and the reason they're open is because people want to be buried in the graveyards. And so the only function the primary function that the Swedish churches, most of the Lutheran churches, hold is as burial grounds. And you'll go and see that all the burial grounds are tended and cared for, and there's maybe one, you know, church service a week or even every couple weeks, depending on how far out in the countryside you are. And there was a shipwreck, a terrible shipwreck. It was a ferry that went down. I don't know if people remember this, in the Baltic. And the thing that was most upsetting to the Swedish people was whether they were going to lift the ship up, because they really wanted the people to be buried who had died in it. And the government didn't want to spend the expense of lifting it, and, you know, but the people were like, no, we need to be able to bury people. And so there was this idea, there's this place, that, so on the one hand, you have this thoroughly secular society in many ways. There's lots of Muslims now in Sweden. But in terms of most Christians, religion means nothing except for in the relationship to death. So one of the questions that, you know, I have had in my mind is what happens if, you know, what happens as you're dying, or as those around you are dealing with your death, both as you're dying or after, without that religious framework? You know, what do we make use of, or do we have things to make use of? And that is part of the imagination of the pieces that I'm sort of putting together, is trying to think about that. One of the problems is that in the academic world, as Tim knows, the very word secular is fraught with these huge debates that I'm just totally uninterested in. I don't care, like, is secular then? I don't care. All I mean is, when you don't have, you know, an organized religious framework within which death and dying occurs, what happens, and how can we imagine new ways to live in those spaces? So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Your turn.
Yeah.
It's hard to know where to start. I feel like I'd have to read the paper again. But I'm curious, did you ever, at some point in your life, live within a Christian or some other tradition?
Yeah.
If you did, was it, were the deaths, did they play some role your letting go, however that happened, or was it some wholly other thing?
That's a great question. Yeah, one of the things, and I was thinking about this as I was reading it. You know, I mean, I was raised Christian. I was raised Catholic, and my father, my mother, and my brother Daniel were all, and Mary too, weirdly, were all still Catholic. So that when they were dying, for them, that was part of it, to a greater or lesser degree. Whereas Pedro, Michael, and me, and my sisters, you know, for others of us, it wasn't part of it. And so it's that interesting. And the other thing I noticed is that my brother Daniel, who's probably the most religious member of my sibling group, you know, when he was dying, he didn't want the priest in there. He was doing it as a thoroughly secular person. Whereas my sister Mary was, like, you know, doing imaginary rosary beads. So, and I don't know whether, I literally don't know if that's a post-pre-Vatican II thing, because she was older, you know. I mean, there was something sort of physically that she was doing, not even aware that she was doing it, that was entirely different from my brother, who was closer to me in age. But he was the one, when my mom was dying, he was the one who, you know, we'd all been trying to care for her and do these various things. And I went in one day and he was sitting reading her the Bible, and I was like, oh yeah, right, good, you know, yeah. It never even occurred to me to do it. And I don't know, yeah, no, it meant something to her at that point. She was very conscious. So the stories that I'm telling occupy this funny kind of liminal space where there's my way of responding to it, and in some cases, my brother's responses to it, and then there's the fact that there's this broad Catholic frame that, you know, funerals took place in, and some of the end of life care had to do with. So it's a complicated scenario. Yeah, that's okay.
I'm going to say something, and I guess my question is, am I interpreting what you said correctly.
Sure.
I thought it was beautiful. But what I took away from it, in a sense, was whether it's secular or whether it's religious, that what is so important about the moment of dying is living.
Yeah.
Is living with what makes you feel alive.
Yeah.
Until the moment you're dead.
Yeah, that's really well put. And that's the way in which sometimes the secular death thing I just want to leave to the side as a title, because I'm not interested in saying if this is another way of being religiously or I'm not necessarily interested in putting a label on it in relationship to secular, religious, Christian, whatever.
Well, that's what I thought was so beautiful.
Yeah.
It was apart from that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I think that's right. And it is about, and I do think the thing that I have been really constantly thinking about is for the last 15 years or more, is the fact that until somebody dies, they're alive, and whether, no matter how much consciousness or present they are, and I've experienced widely different kind of scenarios, but that they're alive and you're alive and the people around them are alive, and it's like, how do you live in that space? And that's exactly what I'm trying to think about. And what gives you a way to make that space livable in the face of sometimes really just horrendous events and physical experiences. Thanks.
Okay, I'll go again.
Yeah.
Is that allowed? Can I ask two questions?
We give you permission.
Thank you. This is not going to come out well, I'm afraid, but so I'm curious what seems to me to be a juxtaposition between the way in which your performance was disorienting us.
Right.
Not sure always who the
speaker
was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you want to go into the motivations behind that, but so the juxtaposition between that and then the, now again, if I'm interpreting right, with the poetry and the music and so forth, the way what seemed to be a concern is that this was something that called people back to earth and let them soar, that it was something very settling, very orienting.
Mm-hmm.
So the juxtaposition between the disorienting rhetoric and the
question.
Orienting.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. That's a really interesting question. And I think, and that's a really interesting question also in relationship to the question about sort of difficulty in poetry that I started with, and sort of difficulty in the songs that I started with, which I think is in some ways more an intro to the difficulty of the form that I'm going to put before you, and that is about disorientation and a kind of pleasure or a kind of freedom to feel a lot of different ways in that disorientation on the one hand, and on the other hand, the desire for comfort and grounding. I don't have a full answer to that question because I haven't worked it out myself. And it's that question of when, if one is the person dying, do you need something very different than those who are with the person dying may need, right? And so that my, desire to comfort, my mom or my brother or his desire clearly to comfort and have his dad experience some kind of pleasure, are coupled with this desire on Orr's part, but also I feel in myself, for a kind of complexity and a kind of opacity that won't make this seem like it was too easy or simple a thing. The dying, if that's what, the dying of the other person, or the poetry that you love, whatever it may be. And so I think maybe I haven't thought this out in any fully coherent way, but I think maybe part of what I'm trying to wrestle with is the different things that different people, first of all, different people need different things in these kinds of situations just because we're different people. but also that what you may almost crave may be quite different, if that makes sense. And that, although in a weird, in a funny way, my brother, you know, in particular, and I, you know, Ord doesn't tell us enough about his father for me to get a full sense of this, but you know, my brother, he didn't exactly. It's hard to say. He didn't want things to be easy necessarily. And so there was moments when we were saying things that were kind of comforting, things that I thought, is that helping? Or does it just feel then like we're lying to him, you know, his daughter's gonna be okay. We don't know if his daughter's gonna be okay. It turned out his daughter's not so okay. But like you say it because you're in that space and you need to say it. And it wasn't always clear to me that it was in fact the right thing to say. So there's something about the play between difficulty and ease and comfort and discomfort that I think I'm still working out and that you're pointing to. No, it is really interesting. I hadn't thought about it quite that way before.
Any final questions, y'all? Ready for Bill Nye?
Yeah. Something totally different. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's see, our final lecture.
Our final lecture for the comparison project is 3 weeks from tonight. That's going to be on Catholic bioethics. And that lecture we'll be holding elsewhere because this room was reserved. We'll be in the library, Cole's Library, in the reading room, fantastic room facing on the south side on the second floor. The next event in the Calvin community, a series, is going to be on 4/26. I guess that's a week from this coming Tuesday. And Yogi Shah will be giving that a talk on embracing aging. And that one will be here in Sussman. So please come back and have a wonderful night. Enjoy the weather.